afternoon. My name is Angie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Market Education Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. Ciarenza, you may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you very much, operator. Welcome. My name is Rosario Ciarenza, counsel at ISDA. This is the ISDA 2010 Higher Act Protocol Market Education Call. We have a couple of speakers. So we have Bruce Kale from Milbank, who's outside tax counsel to ISDA. Bruce is going to speak to the substantive changes to the ISDA Master Agreement and schedule that would be made by the Higher Act Protocol published by ISDA on Monday, August 23rd. To the extent that people are by a computer, if you would like to go to the ISDA website, there's a link to ISDA protocols on the left-hand side. And if you click on that, it'll open up a new screen and click on the ISDA 2010 Higher Act Protocol link. At the bottom of that page, you'll see a link to the memo prepared by Bruce. And it may be helpful if folks have that in front of them as Bruce walks us through the changes. Also on the line is David Felsenthal from Clifford Chance, outside counsel to ISDA, advising on drafting of the protocol documents. Time permitting, David will discuss the protocol procedure. In addition to Bruce and David, we also have on the line Tom Prevost and Humberto Reboreto from Credit Suisse and Antonio Corby from ISDA. They'll also be available to answer questions. The way that we set up the call today is, once again, Bruce will walk through the substantive changes and pause at different intervals for questions. So if you could please queue up your questions to the extent you have questions. When the operator announces, we'll open up the line for questions. You can ask those questions. And then obviously at the end of the presentation, we'll also pause for questions. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Bruce.
Thank you, Rosario. I'm going to talk largely from the memo that was distributed with the protocol, although not entirely in the order of the memo. The discussion items that I have are going to fall into four categories, and we'll, as Rosario said, pause after each of the four categories for Q&A rather than have me lecture for however long on the whole set of topics. That way people can ask questions when they're fresher in their minds. Let me preview for you the four categories, and then we'll launch in. So please keep in mind as we're going through a category, should you have a question on that category, please follow the procedure that the operator indicated, and we'll be breaking four questions category by category. After just spending a few minutes on background of the Higher Act, the first thing I'm going to talk about is changes to the circumstances under which a gross up would be payable by a U.S. payer to a non-U.S. counterparty, which changes are occasioned by the statutory provisions of the Higher Act, both in terms of the gross up provisions themselves and related representations. The second subject that I'll talk about are additional termination rights that are given in connection with a change in law, and I use that term as a term of art here, occasioned by the Higher Act. Third, we're going to talk about clarification to the definition of tax event, which is the one item in the protocol that's not specifically related to the Higher Act, and that will We'll discuss the rationale for that. And finally, I'll turn to the effective date of the various changes that would be made by the protocol. So hopefully to give a better understanding of what transactions are affected by what provisions. Just turning to the background for just a very brief period, the HIRE Act, which is an acronym for U.S. legislation, of which tax is only a small part, had some very significant tax provisions associated with it. And the one we're most focused on is a change to the U.S. tax treatment of payments on equity swaps. Specifically, the HIRE Act, in the case of certain equity swaps, would impose a withholding tax of 30% or possibly lower rate if a treaty applies to the so-called dividend equivalent payments made under a swap by a U.S. person to a non-U.S. person. The dividend equivalent payment under a swap is any amount that is determined by reference to or contingent upon the amount of dividend on what would be a U.S. equity and equity security on which an actual dividend payment would be subject to U.S. withholding. The HIRE Act also included, I think as probably people are painfully familiar with, the so-called FATCA provisions, which after 2012 would require certain kinds of information reporting by all sorts of non-U.S. payees or recipients of payments from the U.S. In order to avoid 30% withholding. This protocol, to some extent, also addresses the FATCA provisions of the HIRE Act.
But primarily just in the equity swap context.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. It's the swaps were the transactions we're talking about here are entirely equity swap provisions or equity derivative transactions, and the discussion is all in that context. So launching into the substantive changes of the protocol, first is the set of changes that relates to when a gross up is payable or not. The norm, as I'm sure everyone is familiar, is that all payments on equity swaps were expected to be made without any U.S. withholding. The HIRE Act changed that substantively, so the protocol adapts to the HIRE Act by, in the first instance, recognizing that the so-called dividend equivalent payments that the HIRE Act would impose a withholding tax on are going to be made with or subject to a U.S. withholding. As a result, there's no gross-up for the so-called dividend equivalent payment that's going to be made, or if any, that's made on an equity derivative transaction.
Yeah, Bruce, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
So the HIRE Act, the way it was written, is very bizarre in that it has a few scenarios. Scenario number one is certain equity swaps, not every equity swap right now is the substitute dividend is subject to withholding tax. There are like four enumerated situations where it is subject to withholding taxes. If you cross in, you cross out. If you do it on a name that's not readily tradable on an established securities market, or if you post collateral in a scenario which is very unlikely to happen, but so it's the first three that's the most common. Then then it goes on to say that, well, in 2 years from now, if the IRS doesn't write regs, all equity swaps are subject to withholding tax. So there's this interim situation where certain swaps are subject, possibly all are subject later on, but what we think is ultimately going to happen is they're going to write regs, and then effectively there's going to be new rules as to what swaps are subject to withholding. So we had to sort of deal with all these different scenarios, and that's why it's probably more complicated than it otherwise would be. So, sorry, Bruce, go ahead.
No, not at all. Where the gross-up is turned off, if you will, is drafted so that whatever the universe that Tom is referring to happens to be of those swaps that are subject to withholding because of the Hire Act, it's on the portion of the payments that are subject to withholding because of the Hire Act that the gross-up is explicitly turned off. And the rationale for that is that unlike equity swaps pre the Hire Act, where no withholding was expected here, hence the gross up was provided here, withholding, by definition is expected, so a gross up is not appropriate. Protocol also contains representations that do two things. One, relating to the dividend equivalent provisions of the Hire Act, the representations say explicitly, or have the payee, I should say explicitly, that we haven't taken those actions which under our control we could take or not take, and that would cause the Hire Act to apply and hence attract dividend withholding. So Tom mentioned the categories where the Hire Act applied, and the specific actions that a payee could take are transferring a security to the payer in connection with opening the transaction, accepting the transfer of the security from the payer in connection with the closing of the transaction in particular. There is significant concern in the market. It's not clear that it's the law, but there's sufficient concern that best practices in the market will also not allow indirect transfers, and an indirect transfer may be considered to occur if the trade, for example, is based on market on open, MOO, as we say, or market on close, MOC, as we say, and both parties are trading MOO or MOC, as the case may be, in connection with open or close of the transaction. In general, it's expected that, or in the core case, it's expected that the party who is short the swap, which in most but not all cases will be the dealer, will be trading MOO or MOC, the normal transactional process and pricing has a built-in expectation. So where the payee is the short party, the payee will be representing that it is not trading MOO or MOC, as the case may be. And having that explicit rep is thought to not only turn off the gross-up, because the gross-up is turned off in any event for Hire Act-based withholding, but to provide a basis for the payer to say to the IRS, no, I got all the representations. I needed to make sure that this transaction wasn't subject to the Hire Act, and therefore I wasn't supposed to withhold, so they'll collect from me, and that of course would be vastly simpler for everyone concerned.
Right. So let's talk about that a little bit more. So the point here is that whenever a withholding tax is due, the IRS can collect either from the withholding agent or the actual taxpayer that owed the withholding tax. They can only collect from the withholding agent when they knew or had reason to know that a withholding tax was due. By having the payee make this rep, basically what this does is it takes the payor off the hook as the withholding agent, because they have no reason to know that the payee has done something outside of the swap that could have effectively triggered 871L without the payor knowing about it. So if, for example, let's just use an example where a hedge fund is long the equity with a dealer. If the hedge fund does a total return swap with the dealer at market on close, and if the hedge fund in connection with that trade, so they're going long, they then sold the stock into the market, they would be concerned at market on close that might trigger 871 inadvertently, because it's sort of like an indirect cross. I mean, we don't know exactly where the law is on this, but they're raising these kind of issues on audit right now, so, you know, that's the concern. So what this rep does is basically whoever the payor is, and again, it could be either side, it could be a hedge fund or the dealer, because we're all on both sides of these trades. Whoever the payor is, they know that if this person is rep, that they're not in connection with this transaction, they didn't sell in the market at, you know, basically in market on close, then we don't have to worry about indirect costs. Now, the rep intentionally says in connection with, because we realize that all of us have multiple desks, and it's possible that somebody could be trading unrelated to this transaction and you don't know. And we feel pretty comfortable that the in connection with language is going to be enough to get everybody comfortable with the government that it wasn't a part of that transaction. I mean, they understand that people have multiple desks and that somebody may be doing something totally unrelated that happens to be in the same name. So that's the way the rep is laid out.
And that's an important point about the in connection with, which tracks the statutory language and is intended to allow for the multiple desk situation. And for those of you not versed in the Internal Revenue Code, Tom mentioned Internal Revenue Code Section 871L. That's the operative section in the code right now, just to complicate our lives. Not long after enacting this new code section, Congress enacted changed the code again, and only effective on January 1, 2011, current code section 871L is renumbered or relettered to be code section 871M, which you'll see as the defined term we used in the protocol. So sometimes you'll hear people refer to 871L. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to 871M. They mean the same thing in this context.
So again, this rep helps dealers in a situation where they don't know what the client is trading. It also helps non-dealers, because non-dealers also hedge funds face, for example, dealers in the UK, where they would have the same issue, and therefore they won't be a withholding agent because they've gotten a rep from the dealer. So it basically helps both sides of the market put the risk really on only the taxpayer, the actual payee who could be doing the trading that would cause the problem.
All right, and to finish the discussion of reps, turning from the dividend equivalent provisions of the HIRE Act to the FATCA provisions of the HIRE Act, there are mutual reps to the effect that the payee has complied as of 2013 with whatever may be necessary at that time to avoid withholding under the FATCA provisions. There's one small exception to that. That's where a payee has made an election that allows withholding to be made on a so-called pass-through basis by the payer, and some non-U.S. financial institutions are expected to want to avail themselves of that election. So not going to represent that they're entirely free of factor withholding. But if a non-U.S. financial institution makes that election and is subject to withholding, there'll be no gross up for factor-based withholding to that extent. Those two things go hand in hand. You'll see those provisions addressed in a combination of Section 5 to the attachment, which is the modification to what payments are grossed up for, and the definition of so-called indemnifiable tax, and in Section 8 of the attachment, which are the payee representations. The factor-based representations are mutual. They apply. They apply to both sides of every trade that's covered by the protocol. I think with that, we should open it up for questions on representations and scope of gross up. Operator, if you want to open it up now.
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Kevin Jacobs.
I had a quick question with regards to the FATCA provisions, and in particular, it appears that the way the protocol is drafted, it focuses on the actual parties to the ISDA, but does not necessarily apply to the recipient of the payment. So, for example, if a party to the ISDA directs a wire transfer being made to a financial institution rather than actually receiving a check in settlement of the ISDA, the way that the protocol appears to be drafted is it's asking for the party to say, okay, I have complied with all of the FATCA provisions, but in fact, the FATCA provisions that would be applying to that payment would be those associated with the financial institution to which the payment is made to. And so I wasn't sure in drafting the protocol if that was considered and whether or not the fact that the recipient has the ability of controlling where the payments go to is of any concern.
I'm not sure I'm following your question. You're saying that, I mean, first of all, there is a rep in here that the party receiving it is adhering to FATCA. We would probably separately, you're right, have to also get confirmation from any bank that they're sending the payment to as well.
Right. I mean, the easy example, sorry for cutting you off, is if a U.S. party, if there's two U.S. parties, there's a potential, for example, if I'm in the U.S. and you're in the U.S. and you're making me a payment, but I tell you, instead of making the payment directly to me, put it into my foreign bank account. FATCA, as currently drafted, would apply to that. And nowhere in the protocol, to my knowledge, would the protocol pick up, A, me having to provide this rep because I'm not a foreign party, but B, there's no rep from the foreign financial institution that's receiving that rep, that's receiving this payment, which is obviously not a party to this protocol.
So basically, would you suggest that maybe the rep should say that not only are you going to comply as the payee with FATCA, but any bank that you do business with will comply with FATCA?
I guess that the concern would be whether or not that puts an unfair burden on the party because it's unknown to the party whether or not the bank you're participating with actually does do that. And so I'm questioning, I'm not sure how to address it, and the concern I have is whether or not the protocol as drafted provides a level of comfort that's not necessarily 100% accurate. In most cases, if you're dealing with a foreign financial institution and you're making a payment to that institution, the representation is spot on. But when you deal with when you're not dealing with a financial institution, but you're dealing with other entities and you're dealing with wire transfers going to financial institutions rather than payments made to those parties, it doesn't, my understanding of FATCA is that entity, whatever entity that is, it really doesn't matter what they're doing. It's really who's actually getting the cash, who's receiving that payment. It's not a matter of who's that payment being received on behalf of, but who's receiving the actual payment, and it doesn't seem to be tracking that.
Yeah, let's talk about what we did with FATCA. Basically, you know, as those of you who are sort of familiar with the tax world know, there's this whopping new information reporting rules that are coming out effective 1/1/13. They basically apply to transactions now if they're going to be payments after 1/1/13. But nobody knows exactly what the rules are going to be. Who's going to be? We know mostly who's going to be a foreign finance institution, but we don't know everybody. And there's a lot of requirements that are yet to be laid out. In fact, there's supposed to be a notice, perhaps even dropped today, that's to start giving information on that. So there's going to have to be a bigger protocol on FATCA that talks about more of the issues once we know all of the rules. But in the meantime, what we said is, look, we know equity swaps are going to be subject to FATCA. We know that if you're dealing with a foreign financial institution, that the payee is going to be the person responsible, not the payor, for that withholding tax. So while we're dealing with the with equity swaps in the Hire Act, we might as well deal with the FATCA issue, at least with vis-a-vis financial institutions. Then you're right, there may be more that we're going to have to do down the road that's not covered yet, but we just at least wanted to cover the part that we know is going to already apply. There's no question about it.
The protocol to foreign financial institutions, because it's also imposing it on foreign financial corporations in which they wouldn't have to comply with it under FATCA.
Yeah, no, they would, right? They'd have to.
If the foreign corporation is having a payment made to a foreign bank, the foreign corporation doesn't have to comply with FATCA because the payment is being made to the bank and not the corporation.
Yeah, right. But the foreign corporation still has to give the bank the information in order for them to, otherwise they're recalcitrant account holder.
I think the answer is both in that case, but your point is well taken, Kevin, and when FATCA is addressed more broadly, as it will have to be in the world of swaps, then I think a closer look at this point, and also in the light of further implementation information, will make a lot of sense.
I greatly appreciate it, and I have one other quick writing question, and I can gladly go back in the queue, and I yield to the operator on that.
No, go ahead.
The question I submitted, and I apologize for submitting it late, is pertaining to the how it's drafted with 871M, and it says with regards to taxes pursuant to 871M, and that's the verbiage that's generally used throughout the protocol. And I guess I question whether or not it's the taxes made pursuant to or by virtue of, and whether or not that distinction matters in your mind. Because the 871M is merely recharacterizing.
We understand the point, Kevin. Pursuant to is sufficiently broad that I think it can encompass the actual imposition of tax, because pursuant to, I think, contemplates sort of a chain of interaction, and certainly in the light of the document and the circumstances under which it's published, I wouldn't want to be on the, you know, I wouldn't want to be arguing that I'm still entitled to a gross up, for example, on a dividend equivalent payment because the tax wasn't imposed pursuant to 871M.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I think if we were starting again, I have no objection to say by virtue of. I think we're comfortable that, you know, that the language will serve the intended purpose.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. I just received that question from clients. So thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Peter Adams.
Hello. There's just a very quick thing. I just wanted to make sure that the manufactured dividends on securities posted under a CSA aren't going to get caught as being dividend equivalent payments. Is that correct? Is this out of scope of this discussion?
In other words, if you just post your equities as collateral and as a substitute payment?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not under this. I mean, there is a separate issue if it's U.S. equities and cross-border and the new, you know, the withholding tax that's going on there. But it's not, I don't think it's covered by this, right, Bruce?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
There are no further audio questions at this time.
Okay. We'll go on to the next point, but I forgot to mention in this point of kind of very minor detail that people will notice as they study the protocol more closely. We added to the standard treaty based representations a representation that in addition to interest, other income, or what other provision may be relevant, that a payee is relevant for, is eligible for the dividend article of a relevant treaty. That would be to allow for reduction of the rate of withholding if it is a dividend equivalent payment. Turning to the next significant category, there is an added termination right in the case of a swap that be, or any transaction that becomes subject to withholding by reason of a higher act. The added termination right both applies to the payer and the payee. In a lot of transactions, we understand the payee otherwise has an optional termination right. This will help the payee in those cases where it doesn't have that right. And this is intended to be the so-called optional early termination, sometimes referred to the defined term mutual early termination. As we understand it, this is the more market neutral termination as opposed to payer side or payee side of what would be a termination amount. So the idea is here is twofold. One is that if a payee becomes subject to withholding and is not getting the gross up, it can use this new optional early termination event to terminate at a market neutral price and doesn't have to use the tax event provision for termination at a less advantageous price. The other aspect of this is that the payer who is going to have to withhold probably manually cases things happening in the shorter term, and his operational computer systems are not set up to arrange that withholding, is going to be permitted to terminate on the optional early termination basis. Principally, you know, the principal intention is to, you know, avoid a situation where compliance simply was not going to be possible. There are some, you know, rather complex provisions about the time period during which the optional early termination right can be exercised and the notice for the optional termination. In general, the informing notion is for things that happen under the HIRE Act between September 14th, the effective date of the HIRE Act in March 18th, 2012, at least before March 18th, 2012. There's an 18-month period to terminate, and the reason for that is that 18 months is that that is a proxy for being able to comfortably get systems in order to withhold going forward, presumably while manually withholding if that's possible in the interim. But for things that happen under the HIRE Act from March 18, 2012 on, there's only a 3-month period. March 18, I don't think Tom mentioned that date specifically, but that's the date 2 years out from when the HIRE Act was enacted, which, barring the IRS doing something first, is the date that all swaps will automatically become subject to withholding under the HIRE Act. So because that is an expected event, there's only a 3-month window to terminate after March 18th. And as far as notice is concerned, it's generally a 10-day notice requirement, 10 business day notice requirement. If the IRS happens to come out with guidance that subjects additional transactions to the HIRE Act, which is something you're entitled to do at any time, and the IRS notice becomes, or the IRS action becomes effective prior to 10 business days, then the notice period is suitably short to allow either party to terminate before, if that's at all possible, before the withholding requirement takes effect. Tom, unless you want to add something, throw this one out for questions.
I guess what we're saying is in the next 18 months is when a lot of big changes are likely to happen, so we need more time. This is going to be the big systems situation, right? And then after that, it should be smaller stuff that people can adjust to. That's why the period's shorter, right? And this was sort of discussed heavily with Sidley as MFA's counsel to try and get something that we thought was workable for all counterparties.
And if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no audio questions at this time.
Okay.
Bruce, may I just pause for 1 second? It's a little hard to hear you. I'm not sure if you're speaking on speaker or into the phone, but you're breaking up a little bit. So.
Okay, thank you for mentioning that. Is this okay?
It's still, I think, it's breaking up a little bit, but we'll do the best we can.
Okay. The third item is clarification of the term tax event is used in the master agreement. This is the one change made by the protocol that isn't specifically tied to the changes made by the HIRE Act, but really the overall, I guess you might call it, environmental change insofar as the IRS position and aggressive auditing of equity swaps with a view to potentially asserting the imposition of withholding tax on, you know, on legacy equity swaps where there was a U.S. payer and a non-U.S. payee. What the clarification would do is essentially say that if a swaps dealer or a hedge fund received a notice of proposed adjustment from the IRS or a notice of an intention to make a proposed adjustment and assert the imposition of tax under an equity swap where that tax wasn't obviously expected at the time it was entered into, that other similarly situated persons, meaning persons who entered into swaps that that were substantively intended to structured similarly and intended to achieve the same non-tax withholding result, that those other similarly situated parties would be able to declare that a tax event has occurred by reason of the first parties receiving the IRS notice, and otherwise the normal tax event provisions would apply, including including the provisions relating to the termination, the calculation of the termination amount. The idea here is to address the fact that the IRS is doing something that really wasn't contemplated by the definition of tax event when the term tax event was originally crafted, and that is the IRS is here essentially making law, going to make law or otherwise achieve settlements, the effect of making law through an aggressive audit process and not through the issuance of rulings or guidance or certainly not legislation on the subject with regard to legacy swaps. Questions on that?
Okay, can I just add a little bit more to that?
So, of course.
I mean, for those of you who are not as familiar with what's going on in the marketplace, I mean, basically, most if not all of the major swap dealers and a number of the large hedge funds are already under audit for equity swaps. The IRS has made this a tier one audit issue, which means it's, you know, they got the highest priority, and the commissioner was hammered by Congress for basically allowing all these equity swaps to be done and allow people to avoid withholding tax. Meanwhile, the rules, you know, the regs actually say that there is no withholding on equity swaps. So, you know, the law is actually generally thought to be in our favor unless they can make some sort of agency argument, and that's what the IRS is looking and trying to do. And we don't know the fact pattern that they're going to say, oh, this is the kind of situation where whoever was the short counterparty on the swap is effectively the agent for the long counterparty. And what's going to happen is at some point they're going to decide, probably over the next 6 months, what they want to attack, and then and they will go after all of the dealers and all of the hedge funds for these kind of issues. And once people sort of know, and it'll, we don't know who's going to be the first one to get the notice, but somebody's going to get that notice, you know, the thought is, all right, now we know what the IRS is going to attack. People did not sign up for, you know, withholding tax on equity swaps. We should not continue to make substitute dividends on those kind of trades. You know, people at least need the right to pause and think about whether they want to continue to make substitute dividends on those kind of trades or they want to terminate them, because nobody's expected withholding tax on these swaps, so we don't want to keep adding to the risk.
If you would like to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. You do have a question from Kevin Jacobs. Kevin's question has been withdrawn. There are no audio questions at this time.
That brings us to effective dates. With two exceptions, the provisions of the protocol will apply to all equity swap transactions that either are outstanding on September 14th, 2010, or are entered into from that date on. The two exceptions, importantly, are first for the definition of tax event, or the clarification of the definition of tax event. That will apply only for transactions entered into after September 13th. I'm sorry, after the implementation date, after both parties have signed up on the protocol. So swaps that are outstanding today, when there has not been bilateral execution of the protocol, and a number of parties have already signed up, but we may have an implementation date for at least some, but let's say this is before the implementation date. Swaps that are entered into before today or outstanding today would not be affected by that change. Just the existing tax event definition in the ISDA master agreement would apply. The other is slightly more technical changes, is that the payee representations that the protocol would add are not effective until after September 13th. That caters to the issue properly raised that there are existing transactions where, for example, there was a cross going in, or there were MRO or MOC trades in connection with the opening of the swap, obviously before the protocol was executed, and those reps literally would not be true as of today, if the swaps are still outstanding. So it gives people the opportunity to identify what trades were done before September 14th, 2010, that would be subject to the HIRE Act, and either terminate or redo those trades in a way that the HIRE Act wouldn't apply and the representations would be true.
Pause on that one for a second, because I want to make sure people understand that the rules apply to existing swaps if payments are made after September 14th, if you already crossed in, 6 months ago. So you should be looking through your portfolios and figuring out if you did any crossing in and terminating those swaps, and, various dealers have rules about how they're going to redo the new swaps, what they're comfortable with to avoid it being sort of stepped together. But people need to look at their portfolios if they've crossed in before to figure out whether or not they have a problem for payments made, dividend equivalent payments made after September 14th. This is what the protocol is dealing with, but I just want people to know functionally you have to do with that. It's not just a protocol issue. You need to really look at your portfolio. Sorry, Bruce.
Not at all. Questions on the effective date?
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. You do have a question from Pauline Casimir.
Can I just clarify that the equity swaps we are talking about are equity swaps where there is a U.S. underlying stock?
Yes.
So it wouldn't apply to European equity.
Right. Even European equities that are traded through ADRs are not covered. It's only U.S. equities.
Right. Thank you.
Or indices where there is a U.S. equity component.
Right. Sorry. Yeah.
Your next question comes from the line of Don Lapp. Are ETFs covered under the HIRE Act?
An ETF that would pay a dividend that is subject to U.S. withholding would be covered.
Thank you. There are no further audio questions at this time.
Then my suggestion would be to turn this over to David to address any procedural issues under the protocol. If there were none, there was one technical issue relating to the how the gross up, or technical issue relating to payments where there is no gross up that I glossed over in the first topic, just to make sure we had enough time to get through all our issues, which we could come back to if there are no questions about procedure.
Yeah, the only other thing I would like to add is it really is important that people sign up before September 14th, because you know every dealer is kind of going through and trying to figure out how they're going to handle if clients don't sign up, because you know nobody wants to take this withholding risk. So there's a real fundamental issue as to what trading can occur after September 14th if people don't sign up.
And you do have another question from Kevin Jacobs.
I'm sorry. I tried to ask a question going back to the tax event, and somehow the system dropped me, so I apologize. Just going back to the tax event with regards to the Tier 1 issues, I had two hopefully quick questions, and it seems that the provision, as you stated, solely applies to swap dealers and hedge funds, and I wasn't sure if there was a reason why there was that limitation. So in other words, if a party that enters into multiple swaps but is not deemed to be a swap dealer receives a Tier 1 issue, they would not be able to utilize this provision as a tax event to then cancel the other agreements that it entered into, and I wasn't sure if there was a reason why that was done.
Well, to be honest with you, what happened is when, the MFA and the North American Tax Committee started talking, the MFA wanted to limit it so that there wasn't, you know, just anybody who's under audit that may not be a major participant wasn't really the person that we would focus on for a tax event. We wanted to really focus it on these Tier 1 audit issues, which are really the major swap participants. And, you know, that was the sort of compromise that was reached to try and give everybody comfort that, that dealers or non-dealers are not going to go out and terminate all these swaps, that, you know, without there being something meaningful happened in the marketplace.
And I guess
Kevin, I would point out that for somebody who isn't a dealer or hedge fund, if they got their own notice from the IRS that there's depending on the circumstances, the notice that they receive could be a tax event for them.
That's definitely a tax event for them. The question is it a tax event for others, right?
And it's just not going to be a tax event for others under the clarification unless they're a dealer or a hedge fund.
Right. And so it would be a tax event for that one particular agreement, but not for all of the other agreements that it's entered into.
You could have a discussion about other agreements that particular recipient has entered into, and that would be to a large extent factual, but it just wouldn't be for different parties from the recipient of that notice.
I also don't think as a practical matter it's likely to happen. I think the people they're really focused on are the dealer community and the hedge fund community, the people that are major players in the swap market.
And I guess just to clarify, without this provision, if there was a Tier 1 issue and they weren't able to, if it didn't qualify as a tax event, then in essence the other party would just be subject to a gross up.
Right. Well,
unexpected gross up, but it would be still subject to a gross up.
Basically, if you didn't have a right to terminate, you would the payor would have to keep making substitute dividend payments, and they would not have a right to collect the withholding tax, so they would be basically on the hook for continuing to have to pay the dividend free of withholding tax. I mean, there's an argument that even without this, that the current language is sufficient to actually cover this issue. But given that we knew that there was
this unique situation that was happening, we wanted to clarify it to make sure that there was no confusion about this.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Sin Sheng.
I was just wondering the applicability of this protocol for non-U.S. dealers that are subject to a tax treaty where the swap would be between a dealer that's subject to, say, a 15% withholding rate and a counterparty that's subject to a 30% withholding rate.
Yeah, it still applies. I mean, basically, the way the rules are written is you don't have to be a U.S. payor to be a withholding agent on the swaps. I mean, the IRS has routinely written their withholding rules to effectively impose withholding obligations on non-U.S. citizens, and that's the case here. So if you had a U.K. dealer that was making a payment to a, you know, a hedge fund, and it was on a U.S. equity that was painted under 871M, they would be a withholding agent.
Right, and so the protocol was written with that in mind, I think.
Yes, the protocol would cover that, and it actually doesn't matter whether the non-U.S. dealer is making payments to a party that would be eligible for a 15% rate or 30% rate.
Right. Okay, thank you.
There are no further audio questions at this time.
Do we have time for David to address procedural issues or take questions on procedural issues?
Well, I'll be very quick. This is David. As far as procedure goes for this protocol, it's a standard. Is the procedure parties may submit to the protocol, adhere to the protocol by sending in a letter to ISDA. When two parties have both adhered to the protocol will be applicable between those two parties, and that's all the sort of standard procedure for protocols issued by ISDA. One thing that's a little bit different with this protocol than some others is that this will apply between adhering parties anyway. The future is the master agreement entered into. In other words, all protocols always apply to existing master agreements, but given the technical nature of this, we felt it appropriate that if you have two adhering parties who agree to the protocol, that it would cover all is the master between those two parties. And that's really it on the process side, unless we have questions.
Operator, if we have any more questions, please let us know.
Can I just remind people it's really important that you sign up as soon as possible, because there are going to be limitations on what trading can happen if people are not sure whether withholding tax is going to do on swaps. So we need to get as much confidence in the market as to what actually is going to happen on these trades.
And to that end, to the extent that people have additional questions, as always, please feel free to contact your ISDA contact or submit questions to isdalegal@isda.org. And as I mentioned at the top of the call, there's a bunch of information on the ISDA website. If you click through ISDA protocols, and then ISDA 2010 Higher Act Protocol. So unless we have any additional questions, and if Bruce and company, would you guys like to say anything else before we go?
You do have a question from Daniel Raimondo.
Okay, one question.
Just a quick question. Tom, you keep asking people to sign up. Is there any deadline with regard to the website and how long it's going to be up and on that?
Help me out, Catherine. Is it a month or what's the?
I believe technically the protocol doesn't have an ending date. It's an open protocol, and that was done on purpose in case there were new agreements that were going to be signed after September 14th, where people would still want to incorporate or adhere to the protocol.
All right, but why I keep focusing on September 14th, the thing that I want everybody to understand is even though it's sort of open-ended, don't take a long time to figure out what you want to do, because, you know, we have to know what we're going to do with trading, you know, and payments for after September 14th.
Makes sense.
So,
thanks, Tom.
To be, this is Dave, as a technical matter, there is no deadline in the protocol itself.
Mm-hmm. Your next question comes from the line of Mark Herbert.
I just had a question. The representation concentrates on market on open and market on close almost by definition. Does that mean that sort of using any other sort of pricing when you enter into your swap is sort of deemed to be okay and deemed not to represent cross in, cross out?
Well, I think. You know, the biggest concern we have is the government putting together something like market on open or market on close, where it's easy for the counterparty to execute away from the swap dealer or the swap participant a trade at the same price. If you're doing trades that are not, you know, off a predetermined designated price, then it's harder to replicate it, and we think there's less risk that it will be considered a cross under the statute.
I'll add here that there's probably street consensus on market on open, market on close. Your mileage may vary by dealer as for counterparty as far as their view on risk on other methods of pricing. So, you know, just keep that in mind.
Right. And note that the general rep says the payee is not transferring within the meaning of the Hire Act. So, however the Hire Act ultimately may be interpreted, and if it happens to be interpreted to the effect of some pricing methods and trading patterns other than MRO or MOC are picked up, the payee still is representing that, you know, that it hasn't engaged in those other methods.
Thank you.
There are no further audio questions at this time.
Great. Thank you all very much for joining. The call is being recorded and will be posted on the ISDA website, so please feel free to let your colleagues know. We'll also send an email around to that. And so I'd like to thank Bruce, Tom, Humberto, David, and Antonio for helping out today. And as I mentioned earlier, please feel free to contact ISDA with any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.